You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
Is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 25th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, freelance journalist Christopher Ketchum, on his piece that he wrote over the summer, about the one percenters, particularly in New York, in the backdrop of a massive police crackdown on protesters in Oakland, reportedly using tear gas. Some have accused them of using rubber bullets, using sound explosive devices. This is audio of an Occupy Oakland protester speaking via live stream this morning, just hours after the raid, as protesters were spread out all across the city, regrouping. The audio you heard at the top of the show was their marching just moments ago towards City Hall, where there's a press conference going on. Here's that audio from this morning.
The first thing I saw with my own eyes were four, five, six, they came in first with the motorcycles and came in with sirens going. There go all the CHPs retreating back into the state building right down the street there. Sorry, that's current. Right at 4:30, we heard the sirens. We saw the OPD motorcycles come in first. Then basically within a few seconds, they just stormed the place. Not literally went in and with guns blazing or anything, but they basically, we heard 4:30, and right at 4:30, there was a few motorcycles. And then right after that, all the vans showed up, filled with all the cops in riot gear from many, many, many of the surrounding cities, most of all of them in the same county as Oakland. So we had Oakland PD, we had which I didn't see until after I was able to get across to the other part of the park. We had Oakland PD, we had Union City PD, we had Fremont PD, we had Emeryville PD, which is a neighboring city. Basically, nearly all, minus Berkeley. I did not see one Berkeley police officer standing here with them. So hopefully that's a shout out to Berkeley PD if they defiantly denied requests for backup. No. Whoa, here we go again. Where are they going? They're headed, east on Jefferson. I'm between 14th and whatever. 14th, 15th.
And that was from earlier this morning. So far, the only mainstream news piece I've seen on it coming from 10 a.m. Eastern time, 7 a.m. Pacific time. Oakland police arrested dozens of people at a plaza outside City Hall and at a second smaller camp nearby early this morning. The reports that I'm hearing are more than dozens. It was close to 100 people. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, about 4:57 a.m., officers began making arrests and removing tents, makeshift shelters at the Occupy Oakland protest at the Frank Ogawa Plaza. At 6:15 a.m., police then arrested at least six protesters at a smaller encampment at Snow Park. As she was led away from Snow Park, Mindy Stone, 43, said, "I'm not camping, I'm demonstrating. What they're doing today is disgraceful." Protesters said the police action did not mean Occupy Oakland was over. Some said they would return at the plaza. Reports I've been hearing is that they're going to amass back at the plaza at 4 p.m. today, Pacific. But like I just said, we had at least 10 or 30, about 30 or 40 at least protesters were moving in to City Hall to attempt to get into the press conference that was taking place there. They were met with a wall of at least 50 or 60, maybe 100 police in riot gear. It involved hundreds of officers from at least 10 law enforcement agencies, including California Highway Patrol, the Alameda County Sheriff's Office, various East Bay police departments. Started with an officer speaking on a loudspeaker, "Attention all persons in Frank Ogawa Plaza. It's been determined you're illegally blocking Frank Ogawa Plaza and are the subject to arrest." At 4:50 a.m., some loud bangs were heard after officers lobbed flashbang grenades and smoke rose into the air. This is ongoing. We'll dip back into this as the show progresses. We've got a statement from the Oakland mayor, Gene Kwan. "Over the last week, it was apparent that neither the demonstrators nor the city could maintain safe or sanitary conditions or control the ongoing vandalism at Frank Ogawa Plaza. Frank Ogawa Plaza will continue to be open as a free speech area from the hours of 6 a.m. to 10 p.m.
I forgot that part of the First Amendment where we need to be designated free speech
areas. Free's got an asterisk next to it.
And there's hours of operation for free speech, too.
That's right.
Do I have to? Do I have to wear shoes and shirt too while I'm a?
My understanding, and according to a protester, is that Frank Ogawa Plaza was full of rats days before the protest was there. Weeks before the protest, they only started caring about it when there were protesters there.
It's Oakland.
It's Oakland. If it's not the murder capital of the country, it's pretty darn close on a per capita basis. So there's no indication that there was any more violence or sanitary problems in that park because of the protesters than there were beforehand. She went on to say, "I commend Chief Jordan for generally peaceful resolution through a situation that deteriorated and concerned our community." We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Christopher Ketchum, who just had a wonderful piece in Orion magazine at their blog. We will link to it on majority.fm. We will be back in just a moment. Stick with us.
Lose your mind.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Freelance reporter and author Christopher Ketchum on, well, frankly, a series of pieces that you've written. But let's start with the reign of one percenters. Welcome to the program, Christopher. Sorry. Are you there?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Thanks.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I was just saying thanks for having me.
Now, this piece is a fantastic piece. It's in the September-October issue of Orion Magazine, The Reign of the One Percenters, Income Inequality and the Death of Culture in New York City. And you were obviously writing this piece over the past year or so.
Yeah. Actually, I started writing it back in August of 2010 when I took my daughter, who's 15, on a tour of Wall Street. And we actually came up with a rather filthy, invective-laden title for our tour, which is, you know, appropriate given the nature of Wall Street. And you know, we had a good time walking around Wall Street, cursing at all the various institutions of the banker. And so I began to think to myself, "Wow, man, the Wall Streeter really does run this town." And is there really anything else going on in New York besides this the reign of the one percenter, the Wall Streeter? And it seemed to me, no, there is not.
Well, let me read this one of the final paragraphs of your piece, because I think it's prescriptive, and in some ways it was prophetic. What is needed is a new paradigm of disrespect for the banker, the financier, the one percenter. A new civic space in which he is openly reviled, in which spoiled eggs and rotten vegetables are tossed at every turning. What is needed is a revival of the language of vigorous old progressivism, wherein the parasite class was denounced as such. What is needed is a new resistance. We face, as Hessel describes, a system of social control that offers nothing but mass consumption as a prospect for our youth, that trumpets contempt for the least powerful in society, that offers only outrageous competition of all against all. To create is to resist, writes Hessel, to resist is to create. And then your final paragraph, such creativity, alas, is unlikely in New York. And you go on to say the city is regressing. This sparks no protest from its people. And literally, I think as you probably sent this in to Orion Magazine, or maybe a couple of weeks before or after you sent it in, we get Occupy Wall Street.
I eat my words, man.
Well, listen, you know, it's a huge piece, and the only thing that I think is inaccurate and may have been unpredictable was that last paragraph where you thought it would be unlikely to see this rise up. What do you think, what accounts for that? I mean, both your lack of optimism to see any type of revolt and the fact that we are seeing now, at least to some degree, a growing and aggressive and strong rebellion against this.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, I completed the first draft of that article with more or less that kind of dark and rather despairing ending. I completed it, you know, almost a year ago. So, you know, man, I mean, you see New York, you see what New York is all about. You know, we've got a lot of young people here who are just obsessed with playing the game, with serving the corporate master, with making money, with being, you know, being the you know, getting the big bucks and being part of the system, if you will. And so, you know, New York does not, today, New York does not inspire, or at least as I, you know, as a New Yorker, until the eruption at Zuccotti Park, New York was not a place that was inspiring in terms of alternative cultures inspiring for people to rise up and establish themselves against the corporatocracy. You know, this kind of, I mean, this town is run by corporatocracy. It's owned by corporatocracy. Its very nature is corporatocracy. So there you go.
In your piece, you get into the history of essentially the last great, I guess, populist movement that took place that essentially grew, I guess, in the late 80s. Just to walk us through some of that history, because I think you use it as an example, a call to arms at that time, and as sort of a paradigm from which people could follow.
Right. Now we're talking about the 1880s here.
Exactly.
there's a section of the article in which I discuss the candidacy for mayor of a guy named Henry George. And Henry George was he was a visionary. He felt that that the real problem with capitalism was that, you know, we had given to those who did not do their fair share of work, we'd given to them all sorts of outrageous remuneration, and in particular, he looked at those people who owned a lot of land and speculated on land and could make what he called economic rent. He basically said, all right, we've got a lot of renters in our society, people making money without doing productive labor. So how do you fix this? Well, you change the laws so that you get rid of the renters and so that people have to actually work for a living. Now, today in New York, and one of the great crises that we face in our society is that we in the United States are top heavy with renters, and renters being the finance class who apparently do nothing. They are socially useless, as a great piece in the New Yorker concluded, a piece by John Cassidy. They don't do anything, and yet they get paid enormous sums of money, and they suck away enormous sums from society, and they draw off incredible amounts of economic rent. So in the Orion piece, I drew this parallel back to Henry George in the 1880s, in which, you know, he basically, as running for mayor, he drew a enormous wide-ranging ecumenical following of lower class, middle class people of all races and professions, who basically said, no, we no longer want to be ruled by the renters, by what progressives back then called the parasites. The parasites are running things today. The parasitic class, the hedge funder, the financier, the Wall Streeter, the one percenter, they are running things. And, you know, I think it's high time, too, that the progressive movement today embrace that old muscular language of progressivism that a guy like Henry George back in the 1880s used. You know, talking about the hedge funder and the Wall Streeter as a parasite, because these are parasites. They're blood sucking vampires. They're ticks fattening themselves on society, and something has to be done, man.
And in the follow up piece that you had to the Reign of the One Percenters in a brief post on Orion, you talk more about the the populist movement of the 1890s. Tell us about the populists, and what they basically carried that that message, but they transferred that message into to not just protest, but into political power.
Right. Now, you know, Henry George could be considered one of the first populists, but it wasn't until the rise of the People's Party of 1892, which became known as the Populist Party, that you really had a nationwide movement that demanded demanded a transformation of law in favor of the working men, what were then called the productive classes, against the parasite classes. Now, the populace, you know, arose out of it was an agrarian movement. It was a movement of farmers from the Midwest, basically said that they no longer wanted to be exploited by monopoly bankers and railroad owners who were controlling railroad transport rates and controlling the systems of credit and impoverishing these productive classes, these farmers, who could not survive in the marketplace. So, you know, they envisioned all sorts of things that required decades, a whole generation, two generations to be realized. Now, a minimum wage, an 8-hour a day, they wanted to nationalize the railroads, nationalize the telegraph services, they wanted to create a bank, a people's bank that would regulate money on behalf of the public interest. They wanted to create all sorts of Social Security protections. Now, a good number of these populist ideas first floated in the 1890s, were later put into effect by FDR in 1934 and thereafter. So the populist, the comparison that can be drawn today to the Occupy Wall Street movement is it may take 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years for a movement to actually affect real change in this country. It may be a multi-generational affair, just as it was a multi-generational affair with the populists arising in the 1890s, but not seeing their platform fully, you know, partially implemented until the 1930s.
You know, when you look at the history of the populist movement and that time that it took, and essentially the time that it took for their policies to be at least partially adopted, and the need in some ways for the Great Depression to open up to sort of like be the final, I guess, the final straw that broke the camel's back. In some ways, what we're experiencing over the past 30 or 35 years has been the same model, but used by the right and reactionary forces. Insofar as you had things like the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has been developing legislation to take advantage of moments like these. You've been hearing a drumbeat of the austerity class that has been talking for years about cutting Social Security, about reducing the deficit on the backs of middle-class people. And they have used this economic, this recession, this near depression, if you want, that we're experiencing now, to ram those policies through. In other words, they've had 30 years to sort of build the infrastructure and develop the intellectual underpinnings for these things, and they're using this as that opportunity. Do you think that that we're in danger of actually moving in the opposite direction in the short term, from where the progressives, from where populists might want to go?
Yeah, I mean, there is a chance that we could go far in the direction of really junking the productions that were established by FDR under the New Deal, and there's a chance that could happen. I mean, it would provoke though, such austerity in this country would provoke just an it would provoke a quasi-revolution. I mean, if you, you know, there are a lot of people depend on Medicare and Medicaid. A lot of people depend on Social Security. There are a lot of people depend on these basic social safety nets. We junk them, you will have mobs and riots on your hands. And yes, we are at the far end of a 30-year experiment by the right wing to dismantle these protections, to destroy the regulations set up, what few regulations we have in this country, to rein in and prevent corporations from their predatory predilections. So we're at a very peculiar and dangerous moment, I think, in American history. Which
do you think the right has the ability, and the one percenters, for a lack of a better term, have the ability to see the implications of austerity at this time? I mean, you know, it's small bore stuff. I mean, at this point, but you know, we have. The Senate will continue and has already taken votes to provide some measure of small stimulus and some jobs programs, some relief to the states on the backs of millionaires and a tax increase that would amount to literally $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 on people who are making millions of dollars a year. And it cannot get passed. Do you think that the right now has even the capacity to be aware of how destabilizing austerity measures would be at this time?
Yeah, I think they do. I think the right wing, the very rich, realize what's going on. I mean, listen, in the Depression, you know, FDR was faced in 1934-35. He was faced with gigantic industrial strikes and riots and social unrest, which led him to pass the Social Security Act, which basically a lot of the reforms, so-called reforms of the 1930s, were really half measures. I mean, they were not the full implementation of that old populist vision. They were half measures passed by a guy like FDR, who was a rich man, part of the rich class, who was basically saying, all right, FDR says to himself, all right, man, I got to save capitalism. How do I do it? All right, I'm going to throw some crumbs to the people who are screaming in the streets. So he throws some crumbs and creates, you know, a kind of system that, you know, works to help out the poor and the middle classes. So, you know, today, I don't know if we have anybody who has that vision. It seems like, you know, the rich maybe really see their power so entrenched that the unrest is not even worthy of their attention. I mean, look at the quote-unquote unrest that's been unfolding so far. It, compared to the 1930s, it amounts to nothing. I mean, we're not talking about gigantic industrial strikes that are shutting down whole seaports, whole industries, whole parts of the country. No. We're talking about, you know, okay, an occupation in a couple of city squares in a dozen cities. And a march, for example, on October 5th, October 15th, that draw 25,000 people. Not 400,000 people, not a bonus army descending on Washington, D.C., not, you know, not gigantic Hoovervilles. So,
do you think, you know, we have the capacity to see something like that? I mean, is that something, do you think, that could happen?
Well, I think, you know what, I think it has to happen. If there's really going to be change in this country, we need massive, massive social disruption. We need people, for example, we need a student loan strike where students organize together and they just stop paying their loans. Say, to hell with the banks. Organize 100,000 students together and just stop paying their loans. How about a mortgage strike where you get 100,000, 200,000, a million homeowners together as a class, and they just refuse to pay their mortgages. Just, that's it. Not going to pay it. What are you going to do? We need to have the kind of disruptions where you have transit strikes. Shut down all of New York City. That will change things. A sanitation strike in New York. Stop collecting the garbage. You know what happens in New York, you stop collecting the garbage. I mean, rats and pestilence and nightmare unfolds very quickly. So, you know, these kinds of things, if we're really organized, if, I mean, we being the 99%, these kinds of things could happen. I mean, I don't foresee them actually happening. I'm sort of speaking here from, in a kind of dream world, a quixotic vision of things as they should be, not as they are, alas.
Well, you write in that addendum, in the meantime, the politics of radical protest, the politics of turmoil and disruption, the politics of ridicule and shaming, the politics of the rhetorical rotten egg smashed in the eyes of the criminal banking class, these are the orders of the day. And I guess time will tell. Christopher Ketchum, thank you so much for spending some time and talking to us about this piece, and hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, the cops in Albany, New York, decide not to arrest protesters despite orders from the mayor. Maybe not quite as dramatic as it sounds, but maybe it is. We'll be right back after this. Folks, I want to encourage you to go to majority.fm, read that Ketchum piece. It's a great piece, very fascinating, both pieces, actually. Meanwhile, up in Albany, New York, Monday morning, it was reported, in a tense battle of wills, state troopers and Albany police held off making arrests of dozens of protesters near the Capitol over the weekend, even as Albany's mayor, under pressure from Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration, had urged his police chief to enforce a city curfew. Now, there's been a lot of talk. You know, Chris Hedges in that piece, that interview that he did while he was in Times Square, I guess it was now a week and a half ago, said that the real turning point will be when the blue shirt cops basically decide we're on the wrong side of this barricade. Now, I don't think this is one of those situations, but it's certainly it's interesting, and I don't know the politics that are taking place up in Albany. I don't know the relationships between the state troopers and the city of Albany. But as being as reported in the Union Ledger, I believe it is the Albany Union Ledger, the situation intensified late Friday evening when Jennings, this is the who has cultivated a strong relationship with Cuomo, this is the mayor, directed his department to arrest protesters who refused to leave the city-owned portion of the large park that's across Washington Avenue from the Capitol and City Hall. A state police civil disturbance unit was quietly activated, according to officials briefed on the matter but not authorized to comment publicly. But as the curfew neared, the group of protesters, estimated at several hundred, moved across an invisible line in the park from state land onto city property. "We were ready to make arrests if needed, but these people complied with our orders," said a state police official. However, he added, the state's police supported the defiant posture of the Albany police leaders to hold off making arrests for the low-level offense of trespassing, in part because of concern it would incite a riot or draw thousands of protesters in a backlash that could endanger police and the public. "We don't have those resources, and the people were not causing trouble," the official said. The bottom line is, the police know policing, not the governor and not the mayor. A city police source said his department was also reluctant to damage what he considers to be good community relations that have taken years to rebuild. In addition, the crowd included elderly and many others who brought their children with them. There was a lot of discussion how it would look if we started pulling people away from their kids and arresting them, and then what do we do with the children? Around Friday, midnight Friday, police leaders reported that the protesters were confined to city sidewalks and therefore were not in violations of the city's curfew governing park land. But in truth, the protesters had set up tents in the park and several dozen slept there. So at least we're seeing the state troopers and the Albany police not react so politically as the mayor does in this situation. Where it goes in there, I don't know. But I'll tell you, New York City police even, and certainly the state troopers, those Albany cops look mighty good relative to the police in Oakland and the neighboring counties. Apparently there were cops there even from outside the county in Oakland. Meanwhile, our guy Ian from Occupy Baltimore sends me a link that the City of Baltimore Parks and Recreation Department has refused Occupy Baltimore's request for a permit to legally occupy this space and has responded to their permit request with a set of unreasonable demands, including a limit of 2 people overnight. 2 people. In what world do you say to protesters, we'll let you have 2 people park, sleep out there, and actually think that's a good faith negotiation? I mean, in what world? This is the city of Baltimore effing with these people. That's what this is. And limiting the group to a small area in the corner of the park. Why doesn't the city of Baltimore insist that it be 3 people, but all 3 of them needs to hold a sign up saying, we're pathetic?
I like that they need to be in a small corner of the park.
Right.
Let's just sweep them under the rug.
Right. This is not about camping out, folks. These are not people who come in with an RV and say, hey, you know what? Let's save a couple of bucks and not go to the Best Western. Let's camp out in the middle of a city. These people are not campers. They are protesters. They are exercising their First Amendment right. The city of Baltimore has given the group an eviction deadline of Wednesday, October 26th, to be in compliance with these demands, which would essentially end their movement. So, this is the plan for Occupy Baltimore. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, Nick Espinoza, an organizer of Occupy Minnesota, talks about Occupy Minnesota's very specific demand that they have had since day one of their now, I think, 2-week-long protest. They are also sleeping in public space. Let's hear this.
Well, I think that this is a starting point. It's not the end. We've been here for 2 weeks. I think give it some time and we're going to continue to form more specific demands. But one concrete demand that is very, very specific is a demand for a moratorium on foreclosures immediately here in Minnesota. That was our demand when we set up tents last Saturday. When we set up tents Thursday in front of U.S. Bank. And we're going to continue to do actions until we get that moratorium on foreclosures.
Why did you put the tents in the middle of the street?
We think this is a crisis, and we need to start taking things seriously, and there are folks here.
That's asking for arrest. Is that intentional?
What we intended on doing was drawing attention to the fact that the CEO just doubled his pay while he's taking people's homes away, and to draw attention to the fact that this is a crisis. We can't sit around and wait anymore. We've been protesting, we've been marching for years, and our voices haven't been heard. So you can expect people to find new and creative ways to get their message across.
So that's Occupy Minnesota. We've got to now head into the better half of the program. When we come back, we're going to be talking about one of the craziest ads you've ever, 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 ever seen put out by Herman Cain. And I'm not saying it's crazy on Herman Cain standards. It's crazy on any standards. Also, more, even NPR now is reporting on Marco Rubio's lies. We will break down exactly how much millionaires would have to pay if any of these portions of the jobs bill were passed in the Senate. Of course, they won't be. Former CIA agent basically comes out, says, we tortured and imprisoned the wrong man for 8 years. We'll talk about President Obama's executive decision to help out in the mortgage crisis. How much help will it be? You'll have to tune in the better half of the show. News Corp also in trouble once again. Folks, podcastawards.com. You can vote for us for People Choice or Politics and News, both actually. Make sure that you confirm your vote with the email they'll send. And please become a member of the Majority Report. Support this program. Your support is desperately needed. If you are in Oakland or in any Occupy protest around the country, call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Give us a report about what's going on there. Always justcoffee.coop, coupon code MAJORITY. And you can buy your crap through our Amazon link. We'll be right back in the better half of the program. You can IM me at Majority FM.